You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Thursday, June 30th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, today on the program, an interview with Jared Bernstein, the former chief economic advisor to Joe Biden. Caught up with him at Netroots Nation. We will play that interview. This was literally, he left the White House not even a month ago. And interesting interview. Very interesting interview. Just some house cleaning. Well, not so much house cleaning. Thank you. I want to thank Roxanne Hughes. Coming out of Texas, and we got a story out of Texas today. Thank you for being such a supportive member. Melissa Sanchez out of California, thank you for your membership. And Stephen Casey, coming from my old stomping grounds. I didn't even notice that. In the Beantown area. Cambridge, the People's Republic of Cambridge. I spent quite a long time there. Well, actually, I guess I didn't, relative to how old I am now. I don't know what's happened to the past 15 years. I really don't. All my music, my entire psyche is frozen in amber. It is stunning. I thought I spent a considerable period of time there, but I guess I didn't. Not even like half of the time. Well, I guess not even as old as my daughter is. Oh, God. Sweet Lord. But coming out of Texas. Oh, you remember how folks, Rick Perry was going to save the Republican Party? Right? I mean, we've all been waiting for that zombie Reagan candidate to show up. Rick Perry was going to be that guy. Actually, I think he sounds not unlike George Bush. It would probably be in my best interest for Rick Perry to jump in to the race, now that I think about it. But apparently a new poll coming out from Public Policy Polling shows that Perry is trailing Obama in Texas, which hasn't voted for a Democrat since 1976 when Jimmy Carter, a Southerner, was running on the ticket. Obama leads Perry 47-45%. Aside from the fact that Texas is a disaster, and I mean that in two ways. One, I guess they have actually applied for a federal emergency disaster status because despite his best efforts in praying to the Lord, Perry has not caused it to rain in Texas. I am stunned. I'm shocked. I don't know what to make of this. How is it possible if you ask the Lord for rain, why wouldn't the Lord give it to you? I know why. Because of the sinners, the sodomites that must exist in Texas. It's either the sodomites or just that, you know, God was, hey, listen, I'm a little tied up. I got droughts in Africa. I got to deal, you know, I'm busy. Somebody has been praying to win the lottery in New Jersey. And so I'm working on that right now. I can't do two things. I can't. But it's also a disaster in terms of the Texas miracle or whatever they're calling it. The miracle is that they actually had the audacity to call it a miracle. And I'm not going to get into the woes of Texas, but I think it's reflected in the fact that Rick Perry's own constituents would vote for Obama over him. So it looks like they're going to have to go back to Plan B, which I think is it's sort of reanimating Ronald Reagan. He's not going to be pretty. He's not going to be pretty at this point. Not going to look quite as good as he did back in the day. But he probably will be more lucid than he was by the end of his presidency. Meanwhile, today is a big day across the pond, as it were. 750,000 public sector workers are prepared to walk out in Britain in response to the austerity programs that are being instituted by the British government. Labour leader Ed Miliband joined David Cameron in urging trade unions not to press ahead with today's mass strike, as the scale of the disruption from the walkout has become clearer. I don't know what's happening. We tried to get somebody over there. We couldn't get anybody. There are 2 million children likely to be given the day off today as their teachers man picket lines at school gates. Air passengers were advised not to travel because of striking immigration staff. The court system have plans to run a skeleton service. Up to 750,000 teachers, lecturers, and civil servants may join the 24-hour workout. This is what is known as a general strike. This is illegal in this country, which is sad. But wildcat strikes or not, I guess we'll have to wait until things get really crappy for that. By last night, over 3,000 schools had told local authorities they'd be closed, while over 2,000 would be partially closed. Interesting. We will. I'll have more on this tomorrow when we see the fallout. But there's also massive disruptions happening in Greece, which is absolutely stunning. And my understanding is it's not just confined. Well, maybe, you know, we'll talk about this tomorrow. In the meantime, here is my interview with Jared Bernstein from Netroots Nation just about a week and a half ago. We're going to take a break. We'll come back in with that interview, and then we will have more news. The President Obama had his press conference yesterday, and I don't know, folks. It remains to be seen what's going to happen with this debt ceiling. Who will cave more or first? Well, I know that answer on both accounts, sadly. How bad would the cave be? We shall see. But when we come back, we will be listening to Jared Bernstein. So returning back to Netroots Nation, I am sitting now with Jared Bernstein. He was the, until very recently, the chief economist for the Office of the Vice President, working very closely with Vice President Joe Biden, and is now is blogging daily. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, multiple times per day, I'd say.
Now, what is the name of your blog again? The
JaredBernsteinBlog.com. By the way, I'm also a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. That's my new job.
So let me...
That's my part-time job now that I'm a full-time blogger.
That's right. Well, and...
that's 24/7.
Now, is this your first time to Netroots Nation?
It is.
And you're coming appropriately enough as a blogger.
That's right. That's right. I'm trying to get a better feel for the environment that I've plunked myself in here.
Well... I have to say, I've been enjoying your blog almost since the day you started it. And I want to first ask you just sort of in a broad sense about your experience,
sure.
Because it's rare. Well, first off,
it's just simply rare these days to be talking to someone who was working in the administration or the government in general and is now not sitting on the board of Citigroup or of some other major corporation.
Did I mention I was on the board of Citigroup? Just kidding.
I don't want to.
I'm not on the board of Citigroup.
And so. But
AIG, maybe. No.
Right. just tell me, I'm curious as to what your experiences were and what it feels like to transition back out of.
It was a great experience. I know that as someone who's coming at economics from a more progressive perspective, I think some people view that my experience as having been a contentious one, and I was always, you know, fighting with the rest of the team. Couldn't be further from the truth. Any group of economists are going to have different ways to approach different problems, but the folks I work with were absolutely great. When I think back to my work with Austin and Larry and Christy, Jason and Gene, I mean, the Keynesian imperative, which was so important when the economy was in deep recession, was something that was universally shared, not just by the economics team, but by the president and vice president as well. And it was a great moment to, a great and somewhat terrifying moment to try to really pull this economy from a potential depression back from the cliff, which I thought we did effectively and efficiently. Should we have done more? Absolutely an argument we'll be having for a long time. Could we do more right now? Should we? Absolutely yes.
Well, let's touch it because I think you're perceived as one of the last, maybe it's slightly inartful to say liberal voices or more progressive or more Keynesian voices to be at the White House and to leave the White House. And I don't know, this is looking from an outsider. But let's talk about that notion of, because there's been much written, particularly lately, about that dynamic, about the idea that there needs to be some type of Keynesian reaction to the crisis, and there certainly was one. But what people are discussing now was the idea that simultaneously there was some very real concern in the White House that down the road you may be affecting inflation in such a way that bondholders might get a little nervous.
Not really. There was not so much a concern about inflation in that regard, because I think we all viewed the economy as suffering from a classical demand contraction, which typically leaves inflation to be pretty low. And that happens to be very much the case, especially what we call the core inflation, if you take out the more volatile food and energy components. Where people worry about the bond market is much more in the debt and deficit side of the ledger, where there are always going to be concerns that if bond markets become spooked by the level of debt that the government is carrying, they're going to insist on a very high interest rate premium when they go into the market to buy treasury bills.
And so there was this concern that if we spend too much money, we increase the debt too much. If we spend too much money in the context of actually straight on stimulus, or as I should say, spending as opposed to tax expenditures, that was the one of the arguments as to why you wouldn't get provide too much. I think at one point Tim Geithner has been quoted saying that's too much sugar for the economy. Mm-hmm. Do you think that at one point that notion of balancing that concern about that long-term mm-hmm. problem with bonds overcame the argument for?
Maybe to some extent, it's very dynamic. I don't think that the White House is by any stretch of the imagination. I'm sure what I'm about to say is true. The White House is not out of the job creation business. The White House just the other day was talking about some tax measures that looked to me very much like something you would do in a mode of stimulating more growth in the economy.
Is this the moratorium on payroll tax?
That's right. Employers? The president talked about a payroll tax a credit the other day. There's, I think you're going to hear talk about extending unemployment compensation because the unemployment rate is still so high. People need that, and there's a big multiplier with that. Those folks, you can imagine, spend the money,
right?
And that ripples through the economy in a positive way. So the White House is not out of that business. Your word balance is exactly the right word. Balance means a couple of things. It means that you don't spend, you know, hand over fist without regard for bang for the buck or making sure you're spending effectively and efficiently. And it means you don't lose sight of your unsustainable budget over the longer term. But balance also means that you don't act too soon. You don't. We have a fragile recovery. We have a recovery which is, in my view, a pretty amazing thing given where we were. But it's a recovery that doesn't. It's a recovery that looks like recession to most people in the middle and lower income brackets. So it's much too early to be going to any kind of fiscal contraction or austerity or spending cuts. But it's not by any means too early. It's just the right time to be plotting the path to that sustainable budget.
And it's looking more likely that we're going to actually have some of those austerity measures, doesn't it? I mean,
we are going to have some of those measures, no question about it. And frankly, if you look at the budget deficit in the out years, no matter who's scoring it, whether it's the White House or the Congressional Budget Office, you really will see unsustainable a path where debt as a share of the economy just keeps growing. And that's, you know, what do they say? Unsustainable trends can't be sustained. But let me just finish. Yeah. My point is that, yes, there will be, but it's a matter of when they start. And Bernanke himself, who is no wild-eyed right. Keynesian radical, said the other day, it's a fragile recovery, and if you start going austere too soon, you're gonna choke it off. Look at what's going on in the UK.
Exactly. Well, let me. How do you reconcile the idea that our 10-year Treasury bonds, mm-hmm. The interest rate, I think it dipped under 3 the other day. Yeah. I'm in Netroots Nation, so I lose track of time.
Not following the T-bills. Yeah,
right. But we're looking at sort of some historic lows in terms of rates.
That doesn't surprise me.
But how do you reconcile that with the fear that the debt is going to be problematic and the deficit is going to be problematic down the road?
That's a great question, and I think I can help you answer it. First of all, you know the concept of Occam's razor, I think that's
yes.
how you pronounce it, which is sometimes the simplest explanation is the best one. We have an economy with very deep excess capacity. The labor market has 9% unemployment, but about 16% underemployment. That's over 20 million people who either can't find work or can't find enough work. If you look at payrolls, they're growing, but they're not growing as fast as they need to. Inflation, as we've mentioned, is pretty quiet. So industrial capacity is below its historical average. So there's a lot of capacity, and that means that two things in the bond market. One, it means people don't necessarily have to insist on an inflation premium because inflation erodes the value of your bond holdings. So they don't need to be have a premium for that when they're buying the bond. They don't need the interest rate to be higher in that regard. But also, when the economy is kind of in a weaker mode like this, interest rates tend to be low because the Federal Reserve has them at about zero. So there's all kinds of reasons associated with what any Keynesian economist would look at and see a weak demand. So that's one side of the answer. The other side, so why the fear? Why all that fear? Why don't people just say weak demand, ergo low interest rates, ergo, you know, nothing to be worried about? The fear is based on the fact that that could change pretty quickly. That if investors believe that their investments in U.S. Treasury bills, whether it's the 50% of Treasury bill buyers who are domestic or the 50% who are abroad, often in Asian countries, if they believe that those investments are not safe, they will insist on a higher interest rate premium, and that can turn quickly. But I am of the mindset that it's much more the former than the latter.
All right. Well, I mean, I would agree with that. And we just have a minute here, so I want to just ask you to get off of that more to the experience that you had in coming out of the White House and now to blogging. Which I
by the way, I did a little blogging at the White House.
Well, you know,
White House blog.
You may actually be the first person to actually actively do that. Although I think probably maybe Robert Reich,
he didn't
do it so quickly. I don't think there was the blogs. But what does that do for you from a sort of an intellectual perspective?
Well, you know, with respect to my job at the White House, which, as I said earlier, was the job of a lifetime. and working with the president, the vice president, and economic team, having gone through what we went through, truly an amazing experience. I ought to write a book about it. So with respect to that, I would say that what I'm doing now is truly intellectually liberating. When you're part of a big message machine like that, it absolutely makes sense for nobody to go out and be a cowboy and say, right. I kind of disagree with the president on this aspect of what he's saying. You can't do that in the White House. You can do it internally, and lots of us did, but you need to put a unified face forward, obviously. Being on the outside, really one of the reasons I left was because I was frustrated, not with what was going on inside the White House. I think the president has a great vision for this economy, but he doesn't have any running room, any oxygen, because of the incredibly screwed up economics debate we're having right now, where people can get out there in the news, in the media, in the blogosphere, and say up is down, and completely get economics and the political economy totally wrong.
Right.
So it felt like this would be a good place to try to help give good politicians, progressive politicians like President Obama, a little more running room.
Well, Jared Bernstein, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Sam Cedar on the Majority Report.
That was Jared Bernstein. Interview I did with him at Netroots Nation. I have to say, I'm very proud of that interview. Because I saw him walking by. I'd recognized him from, his blog and his pictures. And I had interviewed him when I filled in for Keith Olbermann on Countdown, right after the tax deal in December, I guess it must have been. And when I asked him to sit down, I don't think he had the notion that I was going to ask him some of the questions I did. And the most interesting, I would actually, if there's somebody out there who's ever had, and I know some of our folks have actually done transcriptions, but if there's anybody out there who can transcribe this interview, just up to the point where I asked him, I'm not too interested in I'm somewhat interested, but not from a transcript perspective. When I ask him about how it feels like coming from the White House to blogging. But there were parts of that interview, I think, that were very, very, very telling. I asked him at one point if he thought, when I brought up the quote from Geithner saying that stimulus is sugar, in other words, it's short-term energy that doesn't help people in the long run. I asked him, Was that balance out of whack? And he started to say, to some extent, and then he caught himself. And then he goes on to outline the possible, how we reconcile the idea that bond rates, return on essentially loans to the U.S. government, are so low. Why would we be worried at this point? Why would the number one policy problem, as perceived by our establishment, be the idea that people won't loan us money in the future if they are so clearly desperate to loan us money? Because that's what, when you have 10-year bond rates under 3%, that shows a real sort of, not a desperation, maybe an extreme word, but a real incentive on their part to loan us money, even at rates that are rather low. It's because we offer so much security. And he's saying things, the inflation premium's not built into it, blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, it is what it is. And there are certainly more mechanisms to tamp inflation at this point than there are means in which to create jobs.
to create demand. I mean, QE2 is just about over. I think I think it ended today. Is it today? QET was the Fed's plan to buy up $600 billion worth of Treasury bonds. That's essentially putting more money into our government. I mean, into our economy. And you'll recall, go back 6 months when they started this. This was going to be hellfire. This was going to be cats and dogs raining from the skies. Not to mention the double whammy of gay marriage in New York. I mean, the skies over Wall Street at this point is shocking. That you can even see the sky. That you can even see any blue between the patches of the cats and dogs falling from the sky. But we were told this is the apocalypse over and over and over and over again. David Stockman, I was on Dylan Radigan with him 2 months ago. He said, this is it. 2 or 3 months away. When QE2 stops, it's all going to collapse. Well, I don't know. I won't be here on Monday. Market's probably closed. But I guess it probably collapse on Tuesday. And so this notion of rampant inflation. But if anybody has the opportunity or ever had the inclination to transcribe one interview, it would be this Jared Bernstein interview, because I think there would be stuff in here for that give a window to what's going on inside the White House. And I think, frankly, I don't want to pat myself on the back, but you know, if you ask one sort of stupid question or one sort of like semi-informed question, it really gives the interviewer a certain amount of confidence. And I had asked him, I said, I can't even remember what it was now, but I said something about inflation. And, you know, I set him up to correct me. And then I came back with the question that I wanted to ask. But, I mean, I'm not quite there yet, but I am very close to that ability of asking a question that then opens the door to other questions that cannot be not answered because they answered that first question. Someday in the membership section, I will explain that dynamic, and I'm still – it's sort of like, you know, learning to be able to dribble between your legs and then doing it in a game. That's basically what it is. So President Obama yesterday gave a press conference where apparently Mark Halperin from is he from Politico? Whatever. The Note. Whatever it is. Some Washington establishment media thing who sits on the panel or a regular contributor or an analyst for Joe Scarborough. Called the president a dick at the press conference, said he was acting like a dick. And then the MSNBC people pretended like they were offended and are now suspending him. The dumbness, there's so many layers of stupid retardedness in this. I can't even begin to express it. But the real issue is not whether or not Mark Halperin actually said the president was being a dick, because the real issue is that, of course, he felt he was being a dick. Now, think about this. The president is being knocked for calling out the Republicans for walking away from the table. The president is being called hyperpartisan by coming out and holding out for some measly closing of some tax loopholes on the very wealthy, as opposed to the idea that the Republicans will not raise the debt ceiling, which has been raised as a pro forma issue time and time again. We shouldn't expect anything different from there. But I guess my point is that the strategy of putting himself out there as a centrist, as a reasoned nonpartisan president, presumably so that he would build a cachet so that he could come out and fight on behalf when it was and show that, you know, well, I'm only doing this because the Republicans are being unreasonable. You've seen for the past 2 years how reluctant I am to be partisan, how it's not of my nature. But yet he comes out and advocates for something that is just a couple of clicks more ideological than saying we need air to breathe. And he's called the dick on the morning television show watched by everybody in Washington. And so my point being that I think that strategy didn't work. I think the old, I'm going to be a centrist. Now, maybe he just is a centrist, which is, I think, probably more likely. And realizes, and rather than the centrism that he was projecting as being a tactic, I actually think his partisanship now is a tactic that he is forced to use because he realizes, okay, there's a shitstorm coming, and I need a safe harbor. So he accused Republicans no less than six times. I love the sort of breathless quality to this Washington Post report of the... he accused Republicans no less than six times. What the fuck does that mean? No less than six times. Like these two reporters whose job it is to report on this press conference couldn't count up exactly the amount? Could have been 30, but it was no less than six because we only could watch half the press conference and we had to skedaddle. That's what that basically means. Like, I didn't watch the whole thing. Now, I have an excuse for not watching the whole thing. Aside from the fact that I'm not a paid reporter to report on that, I was also doing my show during it. Of favoring corporate jet owners over average folks and the party's refusal to consider tax increases as part of the deficit deal. I mean, what do you mean accused? That's their position. And showing a combative side that Americans rarely see. He said Republicans, quote, need to do their job. They're in 1 week, they're out 1 week, the president said, and then they're saying Obama has got to step in. Well, it sounds like he's talking about Kyle and Cantor jumping out of the, but, you know, who knows? He called on Congress to extend a payroll tax cut and make loans to build new roads, reform patents, and advance trade deals. We'll talk about that trade deal. Yeah, congratulations to us. We have a trade deal now that's going to cost more Americans jobs. Americans will face, if Republicans don't agree, by a hard deadline. August 2nd is the deadline now. He suggested the GOP would be blamed for damaging cuts to the National Weather Service, food inspections, veteran benefits, Social Security payments. Yeah. One hopes that they'll get blamed for it. Obama was most animated on the deficit debate, again taking pains to present himself as the one willing to make politically costly decisions about spending cuts. You know, this is all just so ridiculous. Ezra Klein weighed in and said that, you know, it was clear that the negotiations have failed. Frankly, I'm happy for that. I don't like where these negotiations are going anyways. And there's not going to be a default. If the Republicans won't vote for it, the Constitution says what the Constitution says. And at one point, somebody in the administration is going to go, hey, we're not following the Constitution. I hope that there are advocacy groups out there who are lined up on behalf of Social Security, because if recipients aren't going to get their full payments because of this, they then immediately have standing to go and take this to court. And in fact, I would submit that right now, I think you could argue that a Social Security recipient has standing, that anybody who relies on the National Weather Service for reports has standing because of the anxiety and planning that they would have to do now in anticipation of their benefits being cut 6 weeks, 8 weeks out actually does harm to them. That's what you need to prove. We need to prove that there's harm being done. I think somebody could get injunctive relief. I hope somebody's actually out there doing that type of shit. I got to go back to law school. Greg Sargent said, the primary goal of President Obama's press conference, which just wrapped up, was obvious. He was clearly out to pick a major public fight with Republicans over tax cuts for the rich. Many people are saying, basically, the fact that they've gone public now, that Obama has gone public, is indication that they feel that the talks cannot go any further. But we shall see. It's quite possible right now what we're seeing is, rather than an attempt to get the talks started again, that we're seeing people position themselves for the political fallout that is going to happen if we get up against this debt deal, or if the president asks his Office of Legal Counsel, hey, what about this, it's the 14th Amendment, Section 4, right? Let me check my Constitution again. Section 4 of the 14th Amendment. The validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, including debts incurred for payments of pensions and bounties for services in suppressing insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned. I'm going to sue right now. Now, Ezra Klein writes in, I like Ezra. I mean, he's nice as a person, and but that's not the, I appreciate his work to a certain extent. He's very smart. When it comes to certain policy issues, I think he has got a political tin ear, frankly. But be that as it may, he writes a story in response to the idea that it's unconstitutional not to pay off the debt, saying that there are two primary obstacles to anyone trying to sue the administration for actually relying on the Constitution in just simply paying off the debt. One is standing and one is the Constitution. The standing issue, of course, is that congresspeople cannot bring an action to the Supreme Court unless they are harmed in a personal and individual way. That is Chief Justice William Rehnquist who decided that, or wrote that, I should say. And then there's the Constitution that would allow for Obama to do this. But he says, Ezra Klein says, that this actually is probably not a good move politically or in terms of the market. He says, the danger of the debt limit isn't that America won't eventually make good on its debts. We have more than enough money to cover our bills, and the market knows that perfectly well. It's that the fight over paying our debt will be so brutal, so irresponsible, and so unsettling that the market will reevaluate the faith it puts in America's political system to pay our bills, reduce our deficit, and make sound economic decisions in the years to come. The danger isn't that investors never get paid, but that the way they get paid makes them lose faith in the country's management, which in turn forces the entire financial system to reevaluate the safety of a bedrock asset, which is essentially exactly what happened in the last financial crisis, but on a much larger scale. Absolutely 100% wrong. This is absolutely 100% wrong. He is saying laying a constitutional crisis over political gridlock may work in the sense that the Obama administration will win the court case, but it'll fail terribly in terms of sustaining the market confidence in our political system. On the contrary, the assertion that the Constitution says what it says, that the notion of full faith and credit is beyond politics, transcends this bullshit by the Republicans, will restore far more faith. Because any way this gets resolved investors will still have the notion that someday the Republicans could make sure this doesn't get resolved. 6 months, in a year, whatever. On the contrary, this move to simply declare it is beyond the scope of Congress's authority to not pay off debts will do the very opposite of what Ezra Klein is talking about. It will take this issue off the table in perpetuity. It will take this issue off the table in perpetuity, and we will never have this hostage crisis again. And he gives absolutely no evidence whatsoever for this position. It is the fetishist, the fetish of legislative comedy. Not C-O-M-E-D-Y, but C-O-M-I-T-Y. That we're seeing here played out in a just a parade of no! The markets don't care that Republicans and Democrats can agree on something. They don't care about that at all. They just want to make sure that the country's not going to default on its debt. And in one instance, you can say, well, we've put a Band-Aid on this. The wound's going to open again in a year or 18 months or 2 years or 6 months. But we put a Band-Aid on it. Or it's, oh, you know what we found out? There is no wound. There's no wound here. We'll never have to put a Band-Aid on this again because there's no wound. And meanwhile, the IMF warns failure to raise the nation's debt ceiling would deal a, quote, severe shock to world financial markets still struggling to recover from a worldwide recession, says the IMF. I wonder if that's because they feel like, you know, Democrats and Republicans can't get it together. The federal debt ceiling should be raised expeditiously to avoid a severe shock to the economy and world financial markets. Are the people, is the shock going to come from the fact that Republicans and Democrats can't get along? That Ezra Klein piece is just bizarre to me. And meanwhile, the IMF also warned in its annual report on the American economy that, are you ready for this? Rising budget deficits posed a risk to the economy, but it advocated a long-term strategy for reducing those deficits, not steep immediate cuts or tax increases. Cutting the deficit too quickly could slow the weak recovery, the fund said. Which is why this whole, you know, this 1 to 11, Dave Dayan did the math on this. The revenue increases to cuts. It's a 5-to-1 ratio of spending to taxes or worse in terms of what Republicans would have to swallow. 5-to-1 in terms of cuts and tax increases in their deal. And frankly, I have no problem with not raising taxes for another year or two and just have the government spend more. I mean, to borrow, if people are really worried about the debt, then you need to raise revenue from people who aren't using the money, at least in a productive way for the rest of the society. Nobody's going to cut any jobs because they're not getting the same tax break on their the corporate debt. Hedge fund managers are not going to fire. They don't have excess staff because they're going to end up paying a income tax rate on this. These tax cuts are nominal. I mean, excuse me, these tax increases are nominal. But even the IMF is saying, what the fuck are you doing cutting spending in the face of depressed demand? All right, folks, that's the show. Little over. I'm going to continue on with stories. We're going to look into what happens when states have cut their budgets. does that increase or decrease employment? We know Republicans believe that when you cut government, the money's no longer removed from the economy and private sector hires. Well, those nasty, nasty little stats. Also, we'll look into what's coming out of the Senate and the Democrats. We'll talk about this trade pact. They saved this ad job for tomorrow. Oh, but New York has a financing mechanism for green jobs. Oh, and I'm actually going to do a story about Lindsay Lohan. Look how happy Matt is. Matt, you can take your backpack. Matt has had a difficult day. We'll talk about that in the co-show. All right, folks. Listen, if you can become a member, please do. I ask you this every day. I haven't browbet you today about it. Amazon. If you buy crap from Amazon, why not do it through the majority.fm link? You can just click through that link. It's a little picture of Amazon down the corner on the right-hand side. Bookmark it. Use that as Amazon. You will never know the difference, except for you'll hear a certain bounce in my step. You'll see it. Sam's, wow, Sam seems very optimistic today. He's not so apocalyptic. Well, that's because I redistributed that money from Amazon into my pockets. And folks, support fair trade companies and great companies. JustCoffee.coop. It's also great coffee and tea and chocolate. Remind me, I need more coffee. All right, folks. See you on the flip side.